When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 169. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight, very excitingly, I'm heading to southern Italy to talk to journalist, YouTuber, podcaster, and now book author Katie Quinn. Katie, how are you?
Hi, Will. I'm great. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm stoked to be here, and I can't believe I'm number 169. That's dope.
I know. I can't believe it either. I've been looking forward to this one for weeks, so thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
I've been looking forward to it, too. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm going to read a new advert out now, a new sponsor for the podcast. Very exciting. From an up-and-coming company. So let's all give them our support. They're called Lima Grain, or LG for short. And I think we can expect great things from these plucky underdogs in the coming years. It says here that from Lima Grain's UK's market leading oilseed rape breeding program, Aurelia is the UK's number one hybrid variety, offering growers proven performance across all regions. It has exceptional autumn and spring vigor and outstanding disease resistance. Aurelia is a fully loaded hybrid combining turnip yellows virus, pod shatter, and RLM7 foamer resistance. It's like the Batman of OSR varieties, and you can learn more by visiting lgseeds.co.uk. Before we hear about your career and what you're doing now, listeners will have worked out that you're not a native of Italy already. Tell us a bit about your background. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a small rural town in Southeast Ohio. So I'm from the Midwest in the States. And it's a small little college town. It was when I moved to New York City after college that my eyes were opened to so many things, but childhood was really playing in the backyard.
Yeah, fantastic. So did you have an interest in food from an early age, or, you know, were you one of those kids who liked to bake things in the kitchen, or did that just come much later?
Right, like if Junior Bake Off existed now, or existed then, rather. I totally was not that kid, Will. Okay. Like, I mean, I always loved food. I've always been a big eater. but no, I didn't have a particular knack for it, I guess. It was when I moved to New York City that I think my eyes were open to the variety and all of the different things. I was like, wait a second, for like backyard barbecues, there's more than like casseroles and hamburgers on the grill. Like what? Like my little Midwest American brain was just blown because, you know, New York City has everything. And I would just spend entire weekends around Flushing, which is like the real Chinatown, because Chinatown in New York is Chinatown, but it's also like very touristy. Flushing, yeah, Queens is like the kind of real Chinatown these days. And I would just like spend an entire weekend in Flushing and just eating. And my mind was blown.
That sounds absolutely incredible. I mean, for a country boy from Wales, like me, from rural Wales, it's hard to even begin to imagine living in any city, really. But one as huge and exciting as New York. I mean, it just living there must have been such an incredible experience.
Yeah, dude, honestly, like I would really kind of put myself in your shoes my entire life until my early 20s. And I think that's why the move there was so eye-opening. Mm-hmm. It was, and then I spent my whole 20s there, right? So By the time I left, I considered myself a New Yorker, although I smile far too much to be a native New Yorker. Far too friendly for that. No, I kid. New Yorkers are great. It was a super cool experience. I moved there for a job. Otherwise, I don't think I would have moved there. I was not one of those people who like always, you know, the big lights in New York City. I really wasn't. In fact, growing up, I was really scared of big cities. Like I remember going with my family to Chicago and like maybe I was in middle school and I just did not like it. I was like, there's too much. So yeah. And then I was completely surprised when New York totally, totally took my heart.
Yeah, it made me laugh then when you said that you smile too much, because when my sister lives in London, when my parents go to visit, my dad, who is Welsh farmer, when he's walking down the street in London, he says sort of good morning to people and things like that. They look at him as if, you know, like they want to run away. He makes a point of sort of smiling and being friendly. Yeah, yeah, like Crocodile Dundee. So what? Oh my God, what were you?
Dad. Yeah.
Well, yeah, he's okay. What were you doing in New York? What were you working at?
So the job I got that moved me there was I was an NBC page. So okay. NBC is National Broadcast Company, right? A major television network in the States. And a page. I'm not sure if you've ever seen the Tina Fey show 30 Rock.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a character Kenneth the Page.
Yeah, yeah. Her. Okay.
So. Kenneth the Page, like that was me essentially. So
okay.
Basically it's a job for people just out of college, and we're basically let loose in 30 Rock, which is an actual building. It's the, you know, headquarters of NBC.
Yeah.
And just work at behind the scenes at different shows all around the company, politics, sports, entertainment, you name it, kind of you just get to follow your interests. It was the most incredible opportunity and really opened the doors for so many things I've done since.
Sure. Must have been a brilliantly vibrant place to work, I guess, was it?
Yeah. Yeah. Super, super, super vibrant. I mean,
yeah,
it was so I worked for, and we all did, 6 or 7 days a week. It was a year long program and it was full on and no vacations. And we were paid $10 an hour, which to live in New York City is not enough. I lived on peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for that entire year. But it was transformative.
Yeah.
Because again, like coming from a small town in Ohio to New York City. And so my eyes and, you know, taste buds and palate were not just opened, but just what opportunities are and the kinds of jobs people have and like what is like what I could do with my life. It was just like a completely transformative year.
Fantastic. Okay. So I guess your life was kind of flying along. And then something occurred that ultimately ended up changing your life completely. What happened?
Yeah. So this was maybe about 5 years after the Page program. So I did this program where I just talked about, like worked at NBC or worked at the Saturday Night Live and Today Show and all these exciting entertainment places. And then I got a full-time job at the Today Show, which is their morning show. And from there, got a job hosting at a video news startup. So it was, you know, putting on my host gear every day and really like following the career of my dreams. Everything was going beautifully.
Yeah.
And then what you just referenced, I got in a major ski accident, a really, really bad ski accident. Traumatic brain injury, hospital for a week. I have no memory of that time. And everything that I was doing and this momentum that I had completely came to a halt because I couldn't walk. I was reverted to like almost a 2-year-old's body. I didn't have control over my limbs. And I knew that my brain wasn't where it should be. I knew I wasn't myself. So it was this sense of like, I know I'm not myself. I know I have abilities that I am not able to do. And And everything was just completely halted. I moved back in with my parents for some time to recover.
It must have been incredibly scary time. I mean, did you worry that you wouldn't be able to walk again? I guess you must have done.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know if I would ever get back. I'm sorry, I'm laughing because I can see in my husband's arm over there. I'm like, what is that? He's stretching, and that was funny. anyway, well, okay. So you say there's my husband, and that's the best thing about COVID, right? And like hilarious family in the background of Zoom calls is the best
very
thing.
Much so.
So my now husband, actually, this is related to the story, in that we had essentially just started dating when I had the ski accident. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about being like, was I scared? And yeah, absolutely. It was all a horrible feeling of not knowing if I would ever be the same, if I would ever get back on track. But this man, Connor, was with me the whole time. And so whenever I stop and think about kind of the circumstance with which I really fell in love with him, it's like, okay, you know, here's a keeper. And so the support of my family, really, I mean, like, listen, like a traumatic brain injury is like, we could just do an entire podcast about that. But yeah, I'm so grateful to have recovered, obviously. And it's just like one of those super weird things, Will, where you're like, I never would have wanted this to happen. I would never wish this on anyone. And yet I am so grateful for that experience, because it has determined everything positive in my life that has happened since.
That's lovely. It's nice when good things come out of bad things.
But it's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Yeah. You went back home to your family to recuperate, and were there for several months. Now, in the press release for your new book, it says that you, and I quote, voraciously consumed food to heal, which I love and really, really made me laugh. Can you explain that and where that began to take you?
Yeah. So, well, you know, I've never been like a calories counting person. I've always really enjoyed food. And like calorie counting was certainly not a thing on my mind when I was healing, because it was like my brain needed calories to heal, and my favorite calories were chocolate ice cream. I mean, I would just like, and like the craziest thing too, I mean, this is like, I guess a tangent, but it also just like, you have to listen to your body and like what you want, because like I really didn't put on a pound, like, but I was healing and I reached for certain things, and chocolate ice cream was towards the top of the list. I think this would kind of circle back around this same concept of like listening to your body and what you feel almost on a cellular level called to put in your body. I think that's really interesting. And that is something that led to my book. But I'm getting a little ahead of myself. So this idea of food and food as a healing thing, food as a connector. I mean, because for the first, you know, I'm in my late 20s. I never thought I'd be living with my parents again, but here I am and cooking with my mom with now a new appreciation for food, right? After having gone in New York and done that experience, and after being an adult living alone, and now I'm back home, and just being around the table with them, I just started to think more about it. Things that I had always taken for granted. To me, love and food are so intertwined, and I never really considered it as much as I did in that time. And I think the thing that I'm really grateful about with the accident and this halt of everything great and, you know, the career I had, blah, 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 the halt gave me time to stop and think and introspect. And that led to me picking up the video camera and making videos about that, making videos about food and love and the connection of those things therein. And that, of course, then led to my YouTube channel, which has been then my career, my new career for the past, 7 or 8 years.
Yeah. Let's talk about that. Further down the line, it did lead you to creating your YouTube channel, QKT. And I would highly recommend that anyone listening who has any interest in food, do check that out. And one of the things that I love about it is your wonderful enthusiasm. And you do everything with a huge smile and you laugh a lot. And it's just joyous. Is that something that you plan to do, or is that just who you are and that just comes out in what you do?
Oh, well, thank you so much. That means a lot. I want to say that's who I am. I think that's who I am, but sure, there's an intention there. And that is that I really only want to bring positivity to the world. I want to inspire people. I don't see any sense in putting anything negative or critical even out there. There's enough of that. There's enough of that.
Oh yeah.
And so, yeah, no. So I find so much joy in what I do that. So I think part of it's natural. It just comes through, but a part of it is absolutely purposeful. I want people to leave their experience with me and my content feeling brighter and better and with a smile. So the fact that you said that you smile watching my videos just means the world to me.
That's great. And also my 10-year-old daughter, my eldest daughter, has got really into cookery over the last 12 months. And it's as chaotic in our kitchen as you can imagine, because she uses every single pot and pan and plate and everything when she's cooking, but it is
of
great.
Of course, yeah. The cleanup is no joke.
No, it isn't. And I end up doing that, but, she also loves your videos too. So,
what's her name?
Gwen.
Gwen. Hi, Gwen. Thanks for checking out my videos.
I'll tell her you said that. It'll make her day. As I mentioned in the intro, you live in southern Italy now, which for someone like me who loves Italy and can't wait to get back there, sounds absolutely amazing. How did you come to be living there?
So first of all, you have to hit me up when you come to southern Italy next. I'd love to treat you to an aperitivo on the piazza.
I cannot think of anything better.
So Connor and I moved here at the end of 2020, for two reasons, twofold. I'll make it quick. I'll make it not too long of a story. If for anyone who's interested in more of the details, the nitty gritty, I did a video about it on the channel that you can check out. But so basically, I have Italian ancestry. I have Italian heritage, and actually, while I was researching the book, found my great grandfather's birth certificate.
Did you? Oh, wow.
Teeny little town in Basilicata in southern Italy. Amazing. And really from then I realized, wait a second, like I think I'm actually eligible for Italian dual citizenship. And how awesome would that be? And how many cool free future doors could that open for any future potential children we might have or whatever? You know, it's just this seems like a cool thing that potentially right. I should look into. So that was kind of in the back of my mind. I started collecting more documents. And then, and around the time I was getting really serious about collecting those documents and getting those in, we were living in London at the time. I was working on the book, actually the final kind of drafts of the book. Again, this is the end of last year. And my husband's company, he worked for this fantastic video news company, or it's not the kind of a documentary company called Great Big Story. Folded. The entire company went under. Thank you, COVID.
Yeah.
And with that, we lost our visas to be in the UK. Okay. So we're like, oh God, it's COVID. And we are going to be kicked out of this country in 60 days. And what do we do? And I was like, well, I have all these documents and I think I can become an Italian citizen. Like, let's move to Italy and explore this. Let's see, let's pursue this.
Yeah.
So we did. And now I'm an Italian citizen. It's bonkers, man. It's crazy how fast it's all happened. But
yeah,
so we're living it up and enjoying life here. I want to get a dog, and so who knows how long we'll be here. Brilliant.
And you can see from your videos that you've absolutely smashed learning the language. Has it been fun to learn? What's your Italian, your favorite Italian word or phrase?
Oh, that's such a fun question. Yeah, I've loved learning the language. It's like possibly my favorite thing about this, you know, being thrown into this experience. I'm such a language person. And so, yeah, that's like really tickled my brain in the most lovely ways. So I have so many in terms of like just a pure word, like, you know, the words are so fun to say, like appiccicaticcia means sticky if something, and you know, I just want to call everything sticky, right? Because I just want to say appiccicaticcia. but I think my favorite word/term, and as it relates to food, of course, is scarpetta, fare scarpetta. Scarpetta literally means little shoe, but to do scarpetta, fare scarpetta, means just taking bread and sopping up the leftover sauce or, you know, any of like that juicy, tomato, oily deliciousness that's left over on your plate after you finish your pasta dish or whatever. Scarpetta is just sopping it up with the bread and clean plating. And so I always make a point to fare scarpetta.
That's absolutely fab. I mean, the Italians do have brilliant words and phrases for things, don't they? But that's brilliant. Love that. I'll try and remember that and use it myself. And what are the best things about living there? Is there anything in particular? Is it the weather? I guess it's probably the people, is it?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the people are incredible. You know, Southern Italy too. And Puglia, the region that I'm living in, is known for being outstandingly warm and hospitable. And they really, really are. You know, if we're going by stereotypes, the Northern Italians are a little colder and Southern Italians are a little warmer. And even among Southern Italians, Pugliese are known for being just over, like, come inside and meet my entire family. Do you want to take a shower? Do you want to spend the night? And so even during COVID, when, you know, not all of that is necessarily possible, I've, you know, absolutely experienced the warmth. Again, on the food front, though, I think that something I've really appreciated is how they eat here and what's available in terms of produce. In other words, you know, it's hard for me too, especially living in New York City for a decade and then London for the past 4 years, where every kind of food is just at your fingertips.
Yeah.
I can't find cilantro here for the life of me. Or sorry, I guess coriander in UK speak.
Yeah.
I can't find that here for the life of me. I am hard pressed to find an avocado, right? It's like, really, they eat super locally, super seasonally. And so eating seasonally is something I think I always maybe claimed to do or to try to do that I am actually doing here, because that is what's available. And that is what is at the corner market right around from where I live. And it's overflowing with these incredible, you know, bitter greens called cime di rapa and these amazing little bulbous things that I thought looked like dirty mini onions that are called lampashoni. And they're amazing when you boil them and then soak them in olive oil and vinegar. And it's just so awesome because it's artichoke season, but artichokes won't be around for long. In fact, artichoke season's almost over. So it's like really appreciating this moment. I'm sure as a farmer, you are very aware of it. I'm kind of really just appreciating it and really living it right now though.
It's making me hungry, but seasonality is something we talk a lot about in UK, especially in farming circles and that sort of relationship to food. Have you living in Italy and Southern Italy in particular, have you adapted a football team or adopted a football team?
Oh, that's a good question. So I admittedly am like not a huge sports person, but I know that I need to have
an opinion on this.
Exactly. Well, so the, you know, if we're going by geography, I should sign on to the Bari, mm-hmm. Bari team, because they're my closest.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I know that's not a sufficient answer. I'm sorry.
It's fine. Okay.
Well, what about you? Who's your team? Do you have an Italian team?
Well, if I was going to choose an Italian team, it would be Napoli, because I grew up sort of in the 80s when Diego Maradona was God. So,
yeah. Have you seen the documentary about
him? I have.
It's so good, right?
Isn't it amazing? I watched it a couple of weeks ago. I mean, I don't want to turn it into a football podcast.
What a story,
But yeah, just I mean, the press that just were everywhere and just,
unreal.
Amazing. Okay, let's get to your new book, Cheese, Wine and Bread, which is coming out very soon and will be available in all good bookstores. Cheese, Wine and Bread, the Holy Trinity. How did you initially come up with the idea?
Yeah, it is the Holy Trinity, right? And like, I think that, so I first came up with the idea when we were living in London. We're new to London, new, you know, fresh off the plane from New York City, and really kind of realized, oh, I don't know what I'm doing here. Like I mentioned before, like we went from my husband's job, and I assumed because I create content for the internet, nothing in my life would really change. And like, you know, I totally had like the pretty arrogant New Yorker mentality. It's like, oh, I'm a New Yorker. Like I can handle whatever's thrown at me. I think I was shocked by the transition that in fact took place. And I was like, oh, and I don't have friends here. I don't have a community. and a major turning point was when I got a video project, doing a series of videos for the Comté Cheese Association.
Okay.
That took me to the Jura in France. I spent an immersive week with the cheesemakers, yes, also with the farmers, right, of the French Simmental and Montbéliard cows who make the milk for the Comté. I spent time with the cheese producers, with the affineurs, with the cheesemongers who so appreciated this product and all of their products and had such pride in it. And I was like, whoa, this is a world that I want to know more about. Yeah. The people and the stories and the tradition and the passion. Like there's really something here. Around the same time, I was going back to what my body was almost craving on a cellular mm-hmm. level in this period of transition. It was cheese, wine, and bread. These were the items on my dinner table every day. And so this idea started to form around these three things. As you mentioned, the Trinity, right? Like this triptych, I just saw in my mind, like this triptych, cheese, wine, bread. And then it was when I realized that they are all fermented items mm-hmm. that I found the umbrella with which I knew I needed to explore with writing this book. And because I think a lot of people think of, yeah, sure, they will associate wine and beer with fermentation, mm-hmm. You know, more like the hipster trendiness of like kimchi. I mean, obviously kimchi is not trendy or hipstery at all. It goes back forever. But, you know, kombucha, these things that like, you know, in Brooklyn, it's like, it's hot to be doing now, but it's like, well, I don't think a lot of people realize the daily things that we consume are fermented. And I was really intrigued by fermentation and the process of transformation that takes place when something is fermented, right? Like how does milk, this single ingredient milk, become cheese? You know, it's like there's a transformation that takes place there akin to a caterpillar becoming a butterfly. Yeah. These are two entirely different things, yet one becomes the other, like through this phase of stopping, letting time do its thing, letting bacteria and microbes like work their magic. And then on the other end, here's this like beautiful, incredible, delicious thing. And I guess I was just completely taken with the idea and began cheesemongering at Neil's Yard Dairy. And that's where my learning was like, okay. I started writing then and there, and that's what became my book proposal, and then kind of the rest is history.
Amazing. Well, I've been to Neil's Yard Dairy a few times, and it is like Wonderland, isn't it? Yeah. Awesome as a customer. So working there must be 10 times better. Must be amazing.
Dude, yeah, it is like it is the cathedral of cheese, yeah. Right? Like you walk in and you're like, oh, like full wheels just sitting on the spruce shelves. And like, yeah, it was really, really incredible. And, you know, one of the Neil's Yard Dairy slogans, things that the cheesemongers live by is try this or taste this, which is something we offer to every customer who would come through the doors. And as a cheesemonger, I was, and we are, I cheesemongered there for 3 years, seasonally over the Christmas holiday. It was always such a joy to go back and remember the spirit with which they approach cheese, which is try this, see how this tastes today. And the whole theory of it is these cheeses are not the cheeses that you necessarily grab. It's not the block cheddar that you grab off the grocery store shelves that you know will taste the same every time.
Yeah.
That has its place, sure. Well, arguably, but Neil's Yard Dairy, they're saying this is a fermented product that changes with time, that changes with season, that changes with what the animals, whether it's a cow, sheep, goat, whatever, based on what this animal is eating, right? Mm. There are so many decision-making factors to make cheese, and they're all changing all the time. This is an incredibly dynamic process, and you can taste those decisions.
Yeah.
So here, taste this, try this. Let's talk about what we're tasting. And it was just the coolest thing because literally as a cheesemonger, being encouraged to taste every day and to taste those distinctions between the wheels and to have that conversation with the customers and get their feedback. And then that feedback, like it's a loop, right? Because then that goes back to the farmer and the cheesemaker who make the cheese. It was just a beautiful thing. And it really made me appreciate the system behind this product that I was always like, oh yeah, I love cheese. Like, Katie, what does it mean to love something? What does it mean to love cheese? And so that's where I was able to put my finger on. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
These are the many layers and stories and people behind this amazing bite of cheese.
Yeah. So what was the most surprising thing that you learned about cheese or its production?
The most surprise. Oh my, like it was all pretty mind blowing to tell you the truth. I think it's just going back to what I just mentioned though, about how every little decision can sometimes and often quite literally be tasted. If you know what to taste, what to kind of look for, that these decisions don't evaporate in the cheese room or in the maturation room, that just that real connection, the actual real connection that you can taste and feel with how this food item is made. It was really eye-opening. It might seem like the most simple thing, and maybe your listeners are like, duh, girl.
but it was really awesome. Yeah. And I know from reading the book that you did actually get out onto some farms around the country, which I'm sure will please farmers listening. Did you enjoy seeing where the milk and cheese was actually being produced and meeting the people behind it? It must have been amazing.
Oh, yeah. Well, the people, wow, so inspirational. And there is such a generosity of spirit with everyone that it just touched me so much. But, and also I learned from them, right? And I think that's and just also, you know, not just seeing and learning by watching, but getting my hands really, really dirty. Mm. So I, you know, stayed for 2 weeks, lived on a farm in Somerset, making goat's milk cheese every day. up at, you know, in the cheese room at 6 a.m. Like, let's do this. The goats are milking. Let's do this.
And yeah,
the buckets of milk just like sloshing around and painting my glasses with their milk. And these hands-on experiences were, that's the gem of the book, yeah, right there, is when I am actually experiencing these things and learning. So I think that the thing potentially about my book that differentiates it from other books about cheese or wine or bread or fermentation or any of these things is that I share my learnings about these things with the same, yeah, kind of like open-eyed awe and enthusiasm that you have when you learn something that just like blows your mind, right? Yeah. And you're like, this is the coolest thing ever. And so on that front, I think that people who like where I was at when I first started this, I love cheese. I don't know anything about cheese, but I love it. And I say I love it. People who really know nothing to understand about cheese, wine, and bread, right? So wine in Italy, bread in France, like, you know, kind of repeat this same thing of like, I love this, I'm interested in it, now let me dive in and explore. And then really to, by the end of each section and by the end of each, you know, year of my deep dives, feeling like, wow, like, well, I'm, you know, I'm not one to call myself an expert, but I know this. I know this thing like the back of my hand now. And that journey of newbie to confident consumer, I guess I would call it. I take the reader totally along for that ride with me.
Yeah, very much so. Okay. Let's move on to wine. Something that parents of young children like me have relied on heavily to get them through homeschooling over the last year. How did your journey with that part of the story begin?
Well, first I have to ask, what's your go-to wine?
I like sort of Bordeaux kind of wines, really. The deep red, nice French wines.
Yeah, so you must love Southern Italian wine, yeah, as well.
I do.
Primitivo, yeah. And yeah, because that that bold, like juicy, jammy kind of thing. Yes. They've got that down here. So wine in Italy. Wine everywhere, of course, is amazing. So the way that I kind of break down the book, which I know you know, is that cheese, I deep dive into cheese in England, wine in Italy, and then bread in France. And the reason that I got so specific, because let's be honest, right? Cheese, wine, and bread, Italy, England, and France, all of these three, like I could have chosen, yeah, any one of those items for any one of those places, right?
Yeah.
So it's really circumstantial how I chose and why I chose each item per each country. My thought was to get specific and not just a country and a product, but also my experience and what I was personally going, like I share more personally than I ever necessarily intended to, because I realized in sharing the personal, things become universal. When you get really specific and really narrow, it becomes global. So when I talk about my experiences of being this newbie to London, working at Neil's Yard Dairy, learning about cheese, working at this goat farm, I'm talking not just about cheese in England. I'm talking about cheese everywhere. I'm talking about moving anywhere and that experience of being a newbie and feeling out of your skin everywhere. For everyone, right? So wine in Italy. If I had really understood that Italy has more indigenous grape varieties than anywhere in the world, over 3,000 native grape varieties.
Wow, does it really? Jeez.
Yeah, I would never have been like, oh, let me choose Italy to learn about wine. And, you know, everyone in the wine industry I talked to, like, said that. They're like, wait, why did you choose, like, arguably the most difficult wine country to start? Anyway, I did. And it was incredible. I know through like a friend of a friend of a friend, a family who has a vineyard, a small family run vineyard, up in Northern Italy in Friuli. And, you know, they opened their doors to me and let me work the wine harvest and hang out in the cellar with them. And so that's how my story began.
You did. You went all around Italy to many, many different vineyards. And there must be vast differences between the size of the producers there as well as the techniques they use. Tell us about some of your experiences and the people you met.
Yeah. No, you're totally right. And it's the same with basically it's a similar thing that I experienced in cheese, where I kind of narrowed on these farmhouse cheesemakers, like the artisanal farmhouse cheeses of the UK. But there's also like bigger cheese producers doing their thing. And so I was kind of faced with a similar thing in Italy. There's small family run wineries like the one that I worked at. There's also, just the scale. It's there's also then the huge, conventional wineries that just sell for like $2, €2 a bottle or whatever. So I experienced a lot of the different places, and I definitely ended up narrowing my experiences to the smaller, organic, biodynamic, partially because those are just the places I enjoyed being. Those are the vineyards I enjoyed walking on and, you know, touching the grapes and touching the leaves without feeling kind of icky at the end of it. And those were the people making hard choices about how they were making wine, about the farming, and about what they were doing in the cellar, making the really difficult choices, but very, very principled and very motivated to do things a certain way. So beyond, you know, personally, where I enjoyed to be, I realized these are the stories to be told.
Yeah. Yeah. And some of those families, I guess they've been making wine for generations. You know, the heritage factor of that is so important, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, Will, you know that better, you know, as much as anyone, right? Mm. With your family and your decision to continue it, right? And to raise your family on the farm and do what you're doing in Wales and, you know, touching so many people with what you're doing and the work you're doing. It's really awesome, Will. It's super inspirational. And I found that same kind of like the same awe I have for you and what you do is the awe that I found really in these family wineries in Italy. And in many, many cases, if a son or daughter does not choose to continue the business, it's going to die. It just dies, especially with all of the competition and, you know, the bigger wineries just like taking over. It's hard work and there has to be a passion in it. And heritage plays a huge, huge role in that.
Mm. Okay. One of the things that you've also done in the book, and as I've already mentioned, it is an absolute delight from cover to cover. You've put in some recipes throughout, and we cooked, and I'll try and get the pronunciation right. We cooked your spaghetti all'ubriaco. Is that right?
Yeah, well done.
Not bad for a Welsh country boy. Or as is translation, drunken spaghetti. Yes. It's so good. It was really, really good and super easy to do. It wasn't, you know, just loads of fun.
I'm so glad you like it. Yeah, adding wine to food is become one of my favorite pastimes. Yeah, but it's delicious. Yeah, and Parmesan and the nuts and the parsley. Yeah, I'm so glad you like that recipe. It's a good one.
Tell us, before we get onto bread, just tell us about natural wine. How does that differ from the kind of standard wine that we buy in the supermarket? How much is that taken off in the world of wine production?
So it is definitely a growing part of the wine industry. And it's got people who are passionately supporters of it. But conventional wine is definitely still the norm for wine making and wine consuming across the world. But I'll just kind of give you the really broad overview of the difference between the two. So conventional wine. So it's kind of like conventional wine on one side and natural wine on the other side. Natural wine, which also goes by the term low intervention wine, minimal intervention. Like it's got a lot, like semantics are such a thing in the wine world. It's totally,
I'm sure,
it's totally ridiculous. but so generally speaking, natural wine is used to talk about a wine produced. So if there's two ways of looking at making a wine, in the vineyard, right, the farming aspect of it, and then in the cellar, the fermentation of grape juice to wine, then a natural wine does not put anything in or take anything away. So nothing added, okay, nothing taken away. So in the vineyard, no sprays, no pesticides used, nothing added, no copper. And then, so that's the farming side, right? And then in the cellar, similarly, no added yeast. So you add yeast to the grape juice, right? Which eats the sugars. And then the byproduct is CO2 and alcohol, right? We're all very familiar with the alcohol portion of that. And the CO2, of course, in secondary fermentation can be contained. And that's how we get bubblies, right? Bubbly, sparkly wine. So with natural wine, rather than adding yeast, which Saccharomyces cerevisiae, literally the same strain of yeast used in bread baking, as opposed to adding that yeast to jumpstart the fermentation product, the fermentation process, and to ensure a consistent product, it is using the yeast naturally found on the grapes, which does exist. Yeast is naturally found. It's called indigenous yeast in the vineyard, and it is relying on that to ferment the wine. So again, nothing added, nothing taken away, and it's a riskier production move, right? Because you are giving up the control and the consistency that also a lot of consumers expect when they buy a bottle of wine. So there's some really hard decisions being made, which again, I think is, that's what's interesting. And those are the stories worth telling.
For sure. Okay. Bread. Everyone's been making bread in lockdown. It is the ultimate comfort food, isn't it? I guess it had to be France for bread, really. Where did you start?
So I started with the luckiest meeting ever. I was connected with Apollonia Poilen of the famed Poilen Bakery. Her grandfather started it right around World War II. Her father, Lionel, then really made it a huge thing and brought in the celebrity element, and really just the fame of this bakery skyrocketed. And I met Apollonia, who is incredible and is so driven by continuing the family's heritage, but also evolving with the times. And anyway, met her and, talking about grain to flour to bread and just natural fermentation, which they are very, so sourdough, which Poilen is all about. And that's what I was like, okay, the history of bread in France, how it's changing, what's shaking out now. I was like, okay, that's it. This is it. I'm going for it. So it was kind of a lucky break starting with Apollonia.
I mean, there's a wonderful quote from her that you've put in the book. Anyone can make bread, but Poilen has been around for over 80 years. And if there's something that three generations have cultivated, it's a passion and culture for bread. My grandfather, my father, and I have a passion for our craft. We look at it for not just the beauty of the product, but also the greater symbolism of bread bringing people together, because you don't grow grain just for yourself. I mean, isn't that just wonderful? That just really jumped out to me. I thought it was absolutely fantastic.
I love that. And, she pointed out to me that the word for friend, or one of the words for friend in France, is copain, right? So co pain.
Yeah.
Pain okay. meaning yep. bread in France, right? So co-bread, someone that you share bread with is your friend.
Amazing. Yeah, absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah. So you traveled all around France again and looked at all kinds of different bread and methods of making it and what a gig, by the way. What did you learn about the people who make it and their passion for it?
Oh man, just this like this drive from this place in their being that the mysterious place in our beings that we don't know why we're driven to do things. Every baker that I had the privilege of working with and baking with in their boulangerie or, you know, anywhere around France, they were just so driven and just obsessed with bread and loved the making of it and the mystery of it and the fact that it's so impossible to perfect making a sourdough loaf because the weather changes and everything, it changes. And so everyone I met was just so fascinated by what they did and the creativity inherent in it and the needing to kind of think on your feet and they were so wonderful and so generous. And I think that I was also, so yes, I'm kind of putting everyone in the same bucket in these like ways in which they are all similar, but also something that struck me was how they were all actually very different. And the way that they made their sourdough was all slightly different. And I learned something new from each of them. And they all had slightly different reasons. So some people were really driven by the kind of nutritional part of it. They're like, I hate where bread is going in this country, France, but which is of course everywhere in the world, which is the crappy bread that we're all used to seeing in plastic bags in the grocery store shelves. That's come very far from the bread that we as a people used to rely on. Mm. Not everywhere in the world necessarily, but certainly in France. Yep. You know, that was a health food really, and that fed us. Just so intrigued by that and the different motivations for everyone to do what they do, because it's hard. It is not easy. And when you said like dream gig, I was like, yeah, it really kind of was. It was incredible. But those hours are not
really easy. Early mornings. Even
those hours are not for the faint of heart.
Yeah.
That's like when I worked at the morning show in New York City and my alarm went off at you know, 3:30, 4 a.m. every day.
Gee whiz.
Except for instead of like sitting in a green room offering coffee to the guest, I was getting my hands in flour and water. And it's a tough livelihood. So
for sure. So as a grower of wheat myself, how important is the grain itself and those heritage varieties that you talked about in the book? I mean, the time you spent with Nicolas Soupio. Is that okay? That pronounces that.
Yeah,
that,
Nicolas Soupio. Yeah,
that was fascinating to me. I mean, I loved that bit of the book.
Yeah, dude, grain is everything, right? Grain is everything, and the fact that we have divorced grain from the flour that it becomes, and we've even in many cases divorced the flour from the bread that it becomes, that it makes. That was my biggest takeaway from training with Nicolas. It's all one. And like Nicolas lives it and he breathes it. And that's his whole thing, right? As a paysan boulanger, as a peasant farmer, I stayed for a week on a building on his farm. Right. And so he walks us around and like, hey, here's the wheat stalks, and it's heritage wheat or population wheat, where there's all kinds of terms for it. You know, and then going to his fournil where he bakes the bread, and there's the mill where he mills the grains that I just saw on his farm, right? And then let's all make bread using the flour that he just milled. So it was really just, again, in terms of systems and understanding how things happen, it was like, oh, A, B, C, you know, equals D. Oh, and I get it. I see it. And I taste the difference. And I feel the difference.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. Okay. let's start to wrap this up, because I know you've got loads and loads of different interviews and press stuff to do, but I'm going to put you on the spot now. If you were going to have a simple meal now, outside sitting in the southern Italian sunshine of cheese, bread, and wine, what are the three kinds that you'd pick?
You do know this is an impossible question. Though, yeah. but no, looking outside right now, and I'm looking at blue skies, and actually it has been really overcast for the past couple of weeks here. So I'm like looking at blue skies today, and I'm like feeling that vibe. Like what you just said, I'm like, oh yeah, sun has been away for a little too long, and I'm ready to get in it and do exactly what you just outlined. So here's what my gut is telling me. Sunny, warm, southern Italian day, I'm going to reach for a bottle of Fiano, which is a white wine, which is, you know, again, a native grape variety to the Puglia region, this area. And I am going to, I'm going to get some pecorino in there, some nice nutty pecorino to kind of draw from, kind of like, because Fiano can be kind of like nutty. It can also have like some fruity, almost like honeyness in it, which I think just like pairs really well with a nice nutty pecorino. And then in terms of bread, like I just like that nice hard crust.
Yeah.
Like, stuff, and like pillowy interior country bread, all day, every day. So yeah, just hit me up with that sourdough and I'm good.
God, that sounds amazing. Okay.
I'd probably toast it. I'd probably actually toast a slice of the sourdough, drizzle it with some olive oil. Then there you go. That's my complete aperitivo moment.
Gosh, that's absolutely heavenly. Where can people find the book and your YouTube channel and podcast as well?
So we'll find the book at your local independent bookseller. Of course, it's also on Amazon if you choose to do that. But it's available everywhere books are sold. Basically, should be in the UK, Waterstones, all of my favorite independent booksellers in the States. It's international. So yeah, kind of just Google it and see where you get. And you can follow my stuff on Instagram at QKatie, on YouTube at QKatie. Will, I'm so happy to have had this conversation with you. Thank you so much for having me on.
It's been fantastic. As I said at the beginning, I've been looking forward to it for weeks, and listeners won't know, but I've had to rearrange this podcast a few times. Katie's been very, very patient and understanding. So it's been an absolute delight. And yes, please do check out the book. It's absolutely fantastic. I loved reading it, and so did my 10-year-old daughter. So fantastic. It's been brilliant to speak to Katie, and keep up the good work, and I hope the book is an absolute success. I'm sure it will be.
Cheers. Thank you, and you keep up the good work too. I'll be following along.
And to everyone out there listening, hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.